Hello and welcome to Season 1, Episode 6 of Gaming by Design, the penultimate episode.
Way.
It's hard to believe that we've got here. My name is Colin, and the other voice you heard was Richard.
Good evening, everyone.
This is a podcast where we aim to dissect and discuss the various game mechanics that make video games work. Most importantly, of course, we should say that these opinions are our own, and not those of any of our employers, either past, present, or future. If you want to get in touch with any opinions or suggestions, you can do it by gamingbydesign@gmail.com or check out the blog at gamingbydesign.blogspot.com. Last week, we were discussing luck versus skill in games.
We were, yes, and we had a good time doing it. I think we covered that subject so well, there's no need to ever speak of it ever again.
And this was a podcast topic that you weren't too excited about.
No.
Which is good, because the flip reverse has happened this time, and I'm not entirely confident about this podcast topic, but you've got loads to talk about.
But this is your suggestion, though, for an episode.
I know, so I will introduce it now. Today we're going to be talking about pacing in video games. How do games pace themselves? How do they keep themselves compelling? And how do they maintain a player's interest? Should you go first, seeing
well,
you've got so many points?
Yeah,
jump in afterwards.
So yeah, pacing in games is interesting because I think it's one of the more important skills in game design. Maybe one that's quite subtle and can be quite forgotten, because I think in a world in which the biggest games throw around multi-million-dollar production values, you can literally have all the guns, explosions coming out your ass. Understanding how to construct a game so that there's sufficient variety, there's sufficient changes in paces to keep your player interested is what separates a good game from a great game. And so yeah, pacing can be done a lot of things. It's about variety, I think, chiefly. And that variety can mean a lot of things. It can be variations in literal game mechanics, or it can be changes in the level design, or simply the setting of the game. More often than not, because it's a combination of all of those factors. I guess for this episode, we're kind of just going to discuss games that do it well, why they do it well, games that do it badly, why they do it badly, things like that.
Should I give the key example now of a game that does it well?
You seem to have one particular point you're quite keen to get onto, so we'll work from there.
Okay, so I've literally Googled this. Philip Koulianos
did a
deconstruction of Batman Arkham Asylum, in which he broke down all the key gameplay mechanics, so the sections where you're either walking, seeing a cutscene in a boss battle, or in one of those, I guess, puzzle rooms, gargoyle rooms. Yeah. And the chart is available online, and you'll see that it's very evenly spread. There's a lot of order, and there's no too many of the same sections together. It's a very well-balanced game.
Yes.
And as a result, people say the pacing of the game and the enjoyment of the game is very high.
Hmm. I think first off, I think it's exciting to say that this is now our penultimate episode. This is the first evidence, I think, of genuine research. We actually Googled something with a name and a source, and then we discussed it.
I know. It's like writing a research paper.
Yeah, because generally we just made shit up on the spot based on games we've played, but we actually researched this. But to speak to your point, Arkham Asylum is kind of goes for an approach which is fairly typical of certain sorts of games, in that it has two or three kind of gameplay, I guess, pillars. Let's say that there's a combat, the melee combat, there's the big rooms full of gargoyle stealth sections, and there's the following trails of, Commissioner Gordon's...
Yeah, tobacco.
Musk, or whatever it was.
Musk, yeah. Poison Ivy's poison.
Yeah. Poison Ivy's poison. And obviously there's a few, one-off special sections, like the whole scarecrow bit, and there's a few bits where you just kind of explore and look at nice scenery, or walk around gardens, as you were saying to me earlier today. So the way they kind of structure it is to basically go from fighting bit, stealth bit, fighting bit, stealth bit, Commissioner Gordon's mask bit, fighting bit, stealth bit.
So it's a variety in gameplay mechanics that is making the game compelling.
Yeah, I think basically any one of those things, when you find just two of those things, maybe just repeated would be quite boring. So, but the way that they generate, the way that they pace the game well to add variety is that they have a lot of explicit gameplay mechanics. It's something you come across. Another good example, maybe because it's almost the exact same way, is the Chronicles of Riddick, which is kind of splits up very evenly and in a very regimented fashion between bits where you walk around a hub and talk to people, then stealth bits, and then action bits, and then stealth bits, and action bits, and back to a hub. It's an interesting approach to pacing in your game. It's very deliberate, but maybe arguably a little superficial, maybe a little artificial. I mean,
perhaps, yeah. I mean, it's possible that a player could see through the pacing, through the change of gameplay mechanics, and then be able to read the game and maybe break that fourth wall a bit.
Yeah, I think there's maybe a certain argument for, while Arkham Asylum is, I think, an absolutely amazing game, maybe one of the best games of 2009, wasn't it? Absolutely brilliant. But there is a certain degree which they don't ever really blend the mechanics together. A stealth bit is a stealth bit, a melee bit is a melee bit, and a trail of following a trail bit is a following a trail bit. They don't kind of mesh together, which is something I think is a shame. I mean, you see like some of the truly best games, the way they kind of approach changes of the pace is to the very kind of very naturally flow between different gameplay mechanics, so you don't really see the boundaries between them. Like for example, I think probably the best example of this is basically every game that Valve of software have ever done. Because I think Valve, I think a lot of people would agree, are probably the absolute masters of level design, of game, in fact, game design, when it comes to first-person shooters, at least. And the way that they approach the pacing, where the game very kind of naturally flows from combat into puzzle solving to exploration, it kind of evolves, and you don't really think in your mind, oh, this is the stealth bit, oh, this is the puzzle solving bit.
Yeah, they sort of build ideas, they stack ideas on top of each other.
Yeah.
So that it's less sequential, less split up into chunks.
Yeah, I think obviously we can't discuss this in much detail because you've not played it yet, but Portal 2 does that brilliantly with kind of introducing a mechanic in isolation, and then you, let's say, like the fact that it's got like gels which make you go faster or make you bounce a lot, and then it starts to use those in combination, and the way that it's, and the variety of the pacing is built up because it doesn't just go from this is concept A, this is concept B, this is concept C, you know, this is concept A, this is A and B, this is B and C, this is C and A. It's it's really, really interesting, really sophisticated what they do.
It's sophisticated, but it's easily lent to a puzzle game rather than an action shooter based game.
This is very true. I was thinking about this actually, this very point a lot, and it's kind of obvious for us to say that the way that games create pace, good pacing, is they have a lot of game mechanics and then they go between them. It's quite an obvious statement. So what you're saying, but there's what's more interesting is when you see games that don't have a lot of gameplay mechanics, but they still create variety anyway, because it's about having a restricted set of mechanics, but making the player look at them in different ways and creating variety of pacing like that.
Hit me with some examples.
Okay, the biggest example that I always kind of comes to mind when I think about this is the Gears of War series. Now, there are two Gears of War games. To my mind, Gears of War 1 is, despite being a beautiful-looking game, quite a dull one. It's quite one-note. It's an endless just series of basically big courtyards full of big men who hide behind their cover, you hide behind your cover, and you shoot at them, and that carries on. What made Gears of War 2 a fabulous game is because of the changes to the pacing. And that change of pace and that variety doesn't come from the fact that they added loads of extra mechanics. I mean, sure, there are a lot of extra one-off bits like scripted chase sequences and stuff, you know, the kind of things that big-budget sequels always get. But what they did really cleverly was look at their one simple mechanic, which is that you hide in cover. And more than any other cover-based shooter, they looked at how that act of cover itself could be spun in different directions to make you think about that mechanic. So, for example, start of the game, you hide behind objects, you hide in cover. Right? And that's very simple, that's what all games have. But then, the Gears of War 2 developers, much of their credit, start thinking about that, okay, so we have a thing called cover. What if that cover moved? And you have to deal with that. What if that cover moved because it was alive and you could make that cover go where you want because you could, say, drop berry from the ceiling, which would make your cover, which in this case is a giant slug, move towards that berry. So you now have cover which moves, which you are controlling. And then it goes even further. Think about cover in terms of a resource that can be fought over. So you get towards the end of the game, you get really fabulous cover-based cover battles where there are giant levers that raise and lower the cover. And it's kind of a fight between you and the enemy to raise and lower all the cover in the level. Because if you take their cover down, you can kill all of them. If they take your cover down, they can kill you.
Very interesting. So rather than just having different gameplay mechanics, what they've done there is they've focused on their main gameplay mechanic and tightened it and adjusted it to create variety and pace.
Yeah, I think I read an interview with Cliffy B, as the internet insists on calling him, who did say in an interview that he was inspired very much by the Zelda games. And I think it's really telling. I think the Zelda games, when they're really, really good, what they can do is they will introduce a new weapon in a dungeon. And then they will make you, you know, use it to do one thing. And then you'll think what else you could do with that thing. And then it makes you think about that one mechanic in lots and lots of ways.
It's true. The good thing about Link's Awakening compared to Twilight Princess is that Link's Awakening, it's quite common in the early Zeldas, is that you get a new item that is used within that temple in which you picked it up heavily.
Yeah.
And then when you get out, it's still used. Link's Awakening did this a lot of the time, so the new item that you picked in the temple would open more places in the hub world. But with Twilight Princess, they never really took those weapons out of the temples.
Yeah, I think Twilight Princess, where that fell down, is that I think they looked... All of the new weapon ideas that are in Twilight Princess, I think, are all brilliant ideas. They're absolutely hilarious. But
yeah,
they thought about them too much as, like, novelty ideas. So I guess the example we're both thinking of is probably the Spinner.
Which is amazing. It's got the best boss battle ever.
The Spinner is... the Spinner, yeah, and the ridiculous skeleton-fighting deadly pinball game you have is one of the highlights for me of the entire GameCube generation, even though I know that game did come out on the Wii as well. But yeah, once you leave that temple, I guess the developers looked there and thought, okay, so we've got this mechanic where you stand on basically a giant Beyblade and fly around the map. What possible use do we have for this? And they didn't. They had no answer to that. And it kind of just... Yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame because a lot of games introduce... create pace by introducing new items, new powers.
Yes.
But as we've said with the Valve games, these things should stack. They shouldn't stand alone.
Yeah. I think the best developers understand, yeah, that pacing and variety aren't just about distracting the players with loads and loads of kind of shallow ideas. One thing I'm not really enjoying about Fable, and it's not, we spend a lot of time slagging off Fable on this podcast, which is kind of a shame because I do genuinely like a lot of aspects of them. But I've always felt playing Lionhead's games, but their approach to game design is to basically fill their games with as many different ideas as possible and not worry about the fact that they're kind of paddling pool deep. So,
I understand completely. I mean, yeah, just filling the world with lots of empty options isn't really a way of... It's not really an exciting game, is it?
No, so I'm playing Fable 3 on and off at the moment. I think every episode since episode 1 I've been saying I've been playing Fable 3, and I'm still playing it because I can only play it for half an hour at a time before I get bored, is it has lots of ideas in it, but you do notice while you're playing it, you become quite bored quickly because none of those ideas ever go anywhere. So I recently unlocked the ability to buy businesses. So I thought, I'm going to buy a business. This is going to be awesome because it's going to be like buying a house, but it's going to presumably unlock all sorts of new quests and new things to think about. But no, buy a business... It's just a house. It's basically functionally identical to a house. All you can do is raise and lower the prices it sells at.
And the problem with having so many ideas is that it actually overwhelms the players so much that it actually becomes detrimental to the enjoyment of the game.
I think so, definitely. This is kind of, I guess, a semi-related idea. Whenever people say that, it always comes to mind Prototype. I don't know if you ever played Prototype.
I can't remember. I don't think I did. I think I played Infamous instead.
Prototype was the kind of hoodie emo of superpowers game. So that has a kind of a truly frightening weapon selection wheel. At the end of the game, once you select, you like press the L2 button or something, you see this giant wheel of about 700 different weapons, like 9 million guns, 30 things your arm can turn into, another 10 things your body and your head can turn into. And you look at it and you just go, this is a load of blah. there are so many options you've given me that I genuinely can't think, you know, in the heat of a combat situation, exactly what to do at any specific time.
Is this related to pacing still?
I think so, because Prototype presumably wants to create variety in its gameplay due to the sheer number of player options. Therefore, you know, a combat experience, and most combat in Prototype generally boils down to you're in a street, some soldiers attack you, then some aliens attack you, then a tank attacks you, and a helicopter attacks you. But as you go on, your arsenal increases, therefore allowing you to apply that increased skill set to the situation, and therefore there's more variety ensues. And sometimes it does work, like, you know, ability to like jump into the air, hijack a helicopter, or turn into people to stealthily escape do make fundamental differences to the gameplay. But when you get to a stage where basically you're getting 30 different weapons that are all kinds of identical knives or fists, you kind of, you know, it's not really adding anything to the pacing or the variety of the game. It's just filling the game with distractions.
Interesting. Taking a few steps backwards, we kind of glimpsed over something there, is that the different gameplay mechanics that people create to create pace, do you ever find it weird in a lot of games that there are all of a sudden puzzle sections which might be deemed slightly out of context?
Interesting.
A lot of criticism is leveled at Half-Life 2 for its joy of physics-based, seesaw-based puzzles.
Yes.
And God of War 3 had the Guitar Hero puzzle.
Yeah.
Do you think there is a genuine case for puzzles to be in these games, or do you think the game would be stronger without puzzles?
I think puzzles in games, or at least the brief cessation of killing, is important to me. I think it's a skill that Valve and a couple of developers, like you see Naughty Dog did of Uncharted 2, have the skill of having spades. It's this ability to kind of take a step back from the game and realize we can't just have you killing people for 20 hours. And then, yeah, try something new. So try you having puzzle solving. And I guess in terms of, yeah, puzzle solving is interesting because if you want to have it in your game, you don't want it to feel overly artificial. I guess it's a case of kind of making it fit in the environment. Despite that criticism, which you say, and I have also read this on the internet, I think Half-Life does a remarkable job of making the puzzles feel like they're coming out of the situation you're in, rather than it's a puzzle in a video game. Half-Life 2 especially is mostly about the fact that you can't get to something because physics objects have piled in the front of something because a building's exploded, and that seems very logical. So moving stuff out the way, you know, is kind of, it comes out of the world, the situation.
I think the problem that I always had is that puzzles in those type of games have never really been that much of a challenge.
No, I guess
like
not.
It's normally involved you going to find some things and then put them back in their rightful place. And so it always felt to me like these puzzles were more just like a time block, a way of extending the game artificially.
I guess you have to look at, if we're looking at it quite cynically, and I suppose some games do genuinely do this, yeah, puzzles are a way to make a game last longer. But I think, for me, it's not so much an issue that the puzzles are hard, that they are at least enjoyable to do, and they do provide that kind of breaking up of the experience. I think Half-Life, especially the original Half-Life, would not have been the kind of influential masterpiece it was if Valve had been happy to kind of say, let's make the whole thing just fighting, because, you know, it's 1997, all our other peers are just doing games where you fight things, that's what people like. But they realised that no, if you're going to make something based in a real-world situation, you make it about, you know, problem-solving, trying to work out how to get out where you are, how to jump over there, how to push that over here, and not so much just about shooting everything. It's Valve's realisation of that kind of broke, you know, blew apart so many ideas about game design and kind of led us to where we are now.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. It is good for breaking up. I just remembered now that when I played Dead Space 2, the sections where you do fly about, although not that taxing, I did actually look forward to them.
Yeah, I think if a developer overly worries about having puzzle sections of games and making those puzzles actually difficult, I almost feel like they can do more harm than good. It's more of the enjoyment of the experience than actually causing the player to be stuck for half an hour. I think God of War does it quite well. Maybe their fourth wall breaking Guitar Hero section in God of War 3 isn't, you know, the standout moment of the franchise.
I think the thing that God of War 3, the God of War franchise does very well is that the puzzles are normally broken down into different sections. They're so epic that you solve a little bit of the puzzle, then do a bit of fighting, then come back, and you're still solving the same puzzle.
Well, yeah, which kind of speaks back to the what we were talking about earlier about the best games build on top of each other. God of War, I think, at its high points, which to me is probably the temple that makes up the end of the original God of War, and parts of Pandora's Maze in God of War 3, is that idea where a puzzle is on such a tremendous scale, but it's not so much of, you know, here's a box, just push that box onto that switch, it's that the entire building you're in is a puzzle. Everything is a puzzle, if it's into a puzzle, if it's into a puzzle. And because you're doing that while you're fighting, yeah, you're having about 3 or 4 or 5 boss fights, but you're still actually within the same one puzzle. And that's, yeah, when God of War really excels. It's variety and pacing that comes from working one mechanic, one, you know, kind of gameplay into another kind of gameplay, having them kind of both ticking in your mind at the same time.
Which is good, because I've written down on my sheet here that things would be self-contained, but now I think that's wrong, because Arkham Asylum does these self-contained sections.
Yeah.
They very rarely overlap. God of War 3, and sorry, God of War does the things so that they overlap, and maybe overlapping is better.
Yeah, I mean, I always feel very loath to criticise Arkham Asylum, because I do genuinely think it's utterly brilliant. But one thing I see in this, from what I know about the sequel Arkham City, and one thing I kind of hope, is that maybe break by opening things up into Gotham City and letting you fly across the rooftops and go where you want, is that there'll be a more natural breakup of these mechanics. I think Arkham Asylum does feel artificial, especially its very kind of boxy room-based structure. You almost feel like the Joker is actually getting his guard and distributing in between, okay, that's going to be the stealth room, that's the room where we all hide in the corners, then jump out and fight Batman. Next door, there's going to be some stealth room. They're not going to communicate with the people in the previous room in any way to check what's happening. So while it's a brilliant game, it's also a game that feels very much like a game. So yeah, I think actually this kind of blending shizzle together might actually be a very good approach.
So another way that pace is subtly injected into a game is by imposing time restrictions.
Okay, it's interesting. Where are you going with this?
I hate time restrictions in games. There's nothing worse than when you trigger something and then a timer appears up on screen and then you have to rush around. You always have a counter argument for everything I say. So can you defend timing in video games?
Interestingly, if you'd asked me any other previous week, I would have struggled to find a kind of counter example. But this very week, I'm actually playing a game which use time limits in a way that's surprisingly good. So, okay, I'm currently playing a game called The Bourne Conspiracy, which is obviously a third-person cover-based shooter based on the Bourne franchise. And it kind of came out, I think, maybe before the second film. So it's quite old now. It's pre-trophies. I know that. It's ridiculous. It has an in-game achievement system. It's like living in like 1998 or something. But anyway, it's not a particularly good game, but it's very forgotten, I think. To the point where Starbreeze is apparently working on a reboot of the series, and people seem to have actually forgotten they've already made a Bourne Conspiracy game in the past. Anyway, that game makes massive use of time limits because it's all about that kind of shaky cam, fast-paced Bourne-esque thing where, you know, the camera's always looking at the fucking walls and ceiling, you don't know what's happening half the time, people are running everywhere. The best parts of that game are all timed. The bits where you play a normal third-person shooter, where you walk around, do some stealth kills, hide behind a box, shoot people, unrelentingly shit. I don't know who made that game, but they should maybe play some of the third-person shooters because it's got very kind of clunky, horrible aiming. But the timing-based sections are brilliant because it really captures that feeling of the franchise. We've got to sprint down corridors, barge past guards, slide under security fences. You've got a time limit, but crucially, the time limit is very fake because it says it's given like 2 minutes to run across this Swiss bank, but you actually it takes about 30 seconds. The time limit is there to create the illusion that you are in some sort of deadly situation when you're actually not.
Okay, well, it's quite good to hear a counter-argument, actually. Because every experience of this I've ever had has always been negative. I've always hated it. Ever since, I think the earliest memory of it was in Donkey Kong 64, and I believe the very last level, you were given a timer of 60 minutes.
To do what?
To do the whole last level.
Why? Otherwise, why would you put such a huge, such an apparently large timer in?
I don't know. I think this may have been forgotten over the ages by me, or I might have remembered the facts incorrectly. But yeah, it was a good example of Rare doing something surprisingly rubbish.
Rare do occasionally do things that are rubbish. They did make a game called Grab by the Ghoulies, remember?
And yeah, and what this resulted in is I never completed the game. I was too afraid of failure that I just switched off the game and never completed it.
It's interesting. While you're saying this, it kind of made me think about time limits, and this is kind of a very general theory rule about game design. It's kind of wishing around my head, which I've never actually had time to apply myself in any games I've made, so I don't know about. But I think that a lot of these things in games, it's about the illusion that that difficulty exists, not its actual existence. So in The Bourne Identity, there are seemingly quite harsh time limits to make the player run quickly, to make them think in a blind panic. But that time limit is, in fact, incredibly generous. I stood in that Swiss bank, and it should take a long time for the cops to catch up with me and shoot me. And it's another thing, and we're going to keep coming back to it, but Valve do remarkably well, is you create the illusion that your game is difficult, or that you're doing something that's superhuman or amazing, or you do something that's against impossible odds or impossible time limit. But actually, it's quite easy. Portal 2, which again I won't spoiler for you, does some bits where it creates this illusion that shit is falling apart, that you're in a hurry, the world is falling apart, you must run, you've got to be quick. But actually, it's all bullshit. You're not in any danger, but it's creating that illusion you're in danger.
I'm fine with the illusion. I'm fine with it seeming like you've got to do something quickly, but it's just the physical numbers on screen.
Well, I think that's where, from what you tell me, that Donkey Kong 64 example is a clumsy application of it, because it's put in a number that's weirdly huge. So it's giving you an hour to do something. And if that is like a genuine annoyance. Like an hour sounds like ages, but you can't really think in terms of hours. You don't know how much of an hour it will take to do a whole level.
Yeah, but I mean, I've seen it recently. Call of Duty Black Ops, Killzone 3, they both have these 3-4 minute limits.
I think because I don't think they're using them well. I think that it's probably could be about creating a situation where it feels like you're in a hurry, but maybe not actually including the numbers on the screen. I don't know. In terms of time limits in general, as a kind of a tool for creating variety in the game, I'm certainly I'm quite apathetic to them.
Okay, well, feel free to change subject then.
I was thinking an interesting thing about the way you a kind of technique for creating the change of pace in your game, and it was making me think about the end of Half-Life 2 and the technique I have dubbed the cathartic super ending.
Yes, I know it well.
So of course, it was a very interesting thing that that Valve did. So if you don't know, people at home, and interestingly, if you've not played Half-Life 2, this is a massive spoiler, but...
Well, they can stop listening now.
Yes, so... Okay, good, right. And what they do, basically, is you spend the whole of Half-Life 2, you know, it's kind of a struggle against impossible odds against the Combine, kind of culminating towards the end in this massive over-the-top battle against Striders across the streets of City 17. You then get inside of a Citadel, where the game ends, and it has this amazing change of pace with the most kind of cathartic release of frustration and energy, where you basically become impossibly powerful. And the whole ending is you having a gravity gun that lets you pick up baddies, throw them at other baddies. You never lose any health. Your health is like even increased for some strange reason. You're basically totally fucking unstoppable for the entire last level of the game. Far from the traditional ramping up the difficulty, ending in a huge boss approach in most games, Valve actually kind of sidestepped their slightly disappointing end sequence by making the last level part of the enjoyment of the end sequence in itself. The whole ending is one cathartic release of just crazy super death.
Well, what they've done is they've rewarded the player for completing the game.
Yeah, before the game has been completed, which is the point.
Well, very rarely these days do you actually get a reward for completing the game that is actually worthwhile.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because most games treat ending the game as a struggle. I think it's kind of a traditional approach. The end of the game is difficult. It's fighting a giant monster, or if it's 50 Cent Blood on the Sand, 7 helicopters. And this approach where you actually say, okay, you've had this hot, massive game, the actual end sequence is just going to be a tiny cutscene, and that's not really a reward. So what we're actually going to do is make the end of the game a reward, and you're going to be crazy, and you're going to have to pick up Combine soldiers by the knee, throw them at other Combine soldiers, make them go funny noises, they go, oh! And just have a great time.
And this is the technique that's been copied. And it goes back into the point earlier. And this is a Resistance 2 spoiler. So stop listening now if you haven't played this game.
Uh-oh.
Is at the end of the game, you are given God Hand, which allows you to... It's exactly the same as Half-Life 2.
It is. I suspect they stole it.
Yeah. But what they do is they give you a 6-minute time limit.
Yeah. Yeah, the end of Resistance 2 is very disappointing. Well, not
they give with one hand, they take with the other.
Clever, clever. Because, yeah, I mean, Resistance 2's ending is a kind of, it's a bit all over the place anyway. But yeah, then they have this thing, oh, let's make the player super powerful, but then let's actually make the entire ending some sort of rubbish run where you don't even get time to enjoy the powers you've been given. I mean, it's a massive shame. I think it's a misunderstanding of why Valve's ending is so good.
Do you think that being made super powerful would only work at the end of a game? Do you think that there's arguably sections where this could be added in the middle or the start of the game? In fact, it's quite common to have it at the start of games where you're super powerful and then your powers are taken away.
Yeah, that is a really odd mechanic. I mean, I know it's existed in the Metroid games for ages, but I've only kind of become aware of it recently. I think every God of War starts like that, and so does Prototype.
It's sort of like, hey, this cool shit's going to happen soon, so keep playing.
Yeah, it is like, it's a weird way of making the first level of the game a kind of trailer. It's like, check out all this cool shit that will happen by level 12.
Yeah, so do you think that being made super powerful, yeah, does it only work at the end?
I don't know, really. It kind of depends on the game. I think that one thing that's interesting when you think about pacing is being wary of putting what is maybe the best, most memorable bit of a game too early on, so that your game kind of has nowhere to go.
Yeah, we discussed this, and maybe this is a little bit off topic for this podcast, is that so few people finish games that I think the ends of games are weaker than the beginnings and middles of games.
Definitely. I've always wondered why more developers don't make the beginning and end of their game first. And I guess because in terms of looking at it as a complete experience, that's generally what most people remember, is how a game starts and how a game ends. But I can certainly see, based on what statistics we know, yeah, like it was like 60% of gamers don't finish any games they buy. Yeah, I can see why you would never bother, and that's why you do tend to get all of the best ideas are kind of blown out of a game system way before the end. And I guess what we're talking about here about pacing is learning to kind of ration those ideas so you don't end up in a situation like like the original Dead Space has, and I'm playing the second one at the moment, but I don't really know, where you blow your idea load so early on that you kind of, all you can do is go through the motions.
Dead Space 2 does have quite a few ideas that it does introduce slowly, but the game is longer than it needs to be, and so there are points in the game where you think, okay, you've run out of ideas, and B, this is padding, which leads to another point, is that some games are just far too long.
Yes.
Take out the padding, your game is much more succinct. It's like a film without an editor. They're just far too long, and the game, it would actually be better if you just took out the padding.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, because generally the understanding, and I think this is largely true, is that games these days are too short. I think if you pay £60 for your average Call of Duty game, you're getting about 5 hours of entertainment, and I think a lot of people are saying, that's not good enough. But yeah, I definitely feel that games need to be not afraid to be honest about, this is how much our game has to say in terms of mechanics and ideas and narrative, and let's just make that game. I was always impressed by the Max Payne games, that they knew that basically our game is about the fact that you can jump through the air sideways in slow motion, and that's the only idea we have. So our game is going to be 4 hours long, but it's going to have a fucking good story, so much shit is going to blow up, and you're going to have a great time. And I did, and this is very much a personal thing, but my feelings, not as a game designer, but as a game customer, is that I don't care how long a game is. It's about how the game making the use of the time that it has.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense. You can draw parallels with other mediums. I mean, no one ever says that film or book is too short. It has a message to say, and then it should be said within its time constraints. To artificially pad a game essentially makes the game, it ruins the pacing and can make the game even more boring.
This is true, though. I guess to flip reverse it, what we've not really talked about so far is, without becoming too much of just a slagging off fest, what games kind of handle pacing quite poorly. And for me, it would be a good example would be Black Ops, which I think is overly short. And not only is it short, but it's paced in such a kind of, you know, turn up to 11, sixth gear sort of way. But it's already 5 hour duration. It appears to go, it's supposed to be half an hour of loud, violent noise.
Yeah, it's like watching MTV playing Black Ops.
It is a bit. It is. It. Yeah, it's kind of...
There's so much shit going on, and the set pieces are so epic that you don't have time to digest it. And so yeah. you're not really having that much fun.
Yeah, but then I kind of, whenever I go and see it, we've done this quite a lot, where you kind of slag off Call of Duty in a kind of light-hearted way, because, you know, they're all right games. So I feel like, what the fuck do I know? They sell billions. But for me personally, as a gamer, yeah, I think that as the series has gone on, I think maybe why I consider the early games, like Modern Warfare 1, to be superior to Modern Warfare 2 and Black Ops, is that there was a kind of subtlety of pacing that Modern Warfare 1 had. That kind of, that slow, very surprising build-up with the, you know, the guy being the guy in the car, the brilliant Chernobyl sniper bit that people always go on about, the kind of the Black Ops undercover missions and the open warfare missions felt genuinely different, whereas in Modern Warfare 2, they generally amount to the same amount of killing.
It's an interesting point you're making there. You need the cooldown period to be able to dissect the high-octane bits.
Yeah, I think that... Well, I'm sure the Call of Duty franchise will be successful for many years to come, and I think it, you know, largely speaking, I'd say it deserves it. They're good games, they're well made. But they kind of reached a saturation point where I worry that Treyarch, next time they sit down to think of a Call of Duty game, will find that they've made set pieces so explosively over the top that they literally have nowhere to go.
Yeah, I mean, when I played Black Ops, the set pieces were so thick and fast that they did feel quite boring. Or banal is a better
word. Yeah, you find yourself in a strange position because big scripted Hollywood moments are actually I really love in games, despite how maybe in these podcasts I sound like I'm not a fan of that sort of thing. I love them, but Black Ops can make you so kind of numb to them because it literally overloads you with explosive death feasts so often.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can make the comparison to Uncharted 2, which has big set pieces, but the pacing between them is much more low-key, and so they feel more like a big, epic reward.
Yeah, I think the Uncharted series in general is actually a brilliant example of the sort of thing we're talking about being done well and being improved. I always thought the original Uncharted, while undeniably a brilliant game, is like a lot of first games in the franchise, you know, you've only got enough time and money to get the core idea working. So the original Uncharted is largely just about killing. I mean, there's some puzzles sort of going on, a bit of traversal, but they kind of get bored of that quite early on. And it's just this absolutely crazy Somalian pirate murdering death-a-thon with almost no relenting. And Uncharted 2 does such a great job of understanding that not only is that changing of the pace, that variety, that kind of increase in exploration and puzzle solving good for the gameplay, but it also ends up being much truer to the game world. It makes Nathan Drake more about the Indiana Jones type character he's supposed to be, rather than the, to be honest, mass murdering American wanker that he seems to be in the original Uncharted.
The only criticism, the cammy level that the games is, they do devolve into core fighting at the final third.
Well, yeah, I think maybe Uncharted 2 is, again, as utterly brilliant as this is, maybe, yeah, another example of what we're talking about games needing to realise when they're becoming too long, because once you get to Shambhala, that place that concludes the game, I feel that Naughty Dog have kind of, the well of ideas has run dry, and you're just fighting your way through endless weird blue people with crossbows. And yeah, kind of lost it. You kind of feel like maybe you'd cut back a bit earlier. You'd have a few ideas to save now. We could end like in a nicer kind of high point.
Good. Okay. Well, we're getting on time-wise. Do you have any more points?
Yeah, I've kind of one interesting point.
Okay.
Because we're talking a lot about variety and how a good way to add variety, you know, adding variety is a good way to increase the pacing, like some new gameplay mechanics, new locations, so on and so forth. Can it be done that you add new gameplay mechanics and new ideas, but it actually can backfire because you are adding new variety to your game for the sake of adding variety? I'm speaking specifically to what I like to call adding monsters and aliens to your game syndrome.
Okay, yeah, you can elaborate without spoiling too many games.
So, Crysis. Crysis is a lovely video game in which you fight lots of evil Korean people on a tropical island, and then it adds I guess, simply for the sake of variety, about a third, two-thirds of the way through, flying squid monsters, and the game instantly becomes shit.
Yeah, so it's injecting... it's injecting a game mechanic that isn't a good game mechanic. Is that a way to summarize it?
I guess. I think what...
Or is it injecting a cynical game mechanic?
Maybe it's cynical. I think that's the point I was kind of reaching for. Maybe this isn't the only conclusion we can draw from this. Is that... Presumably, the developers of Crysis spent a very, very long time making these Korean soldiers who have brilliant AI. They react very realistic to situations. They know how to drive cars. They know how to fly helicopters. They're awesome. But then they said, we need a bit of variety in this, so we're going to add aliens in it later. But they have not had the time to give the same depth of thought, the same amount of programming and design time to these as they have for human enemies. What I think, I guess I'm driving at, is that you can backfire when a game... tries to add mechanics for the sake of variety, but doesn't have time to explore them in the same depth.
So this relates back to Fable 3, is that if you're going to add gameplay mechanics, make them well thought out.
Yeah, and I think Perfect Dark does the exact same thing.
It's like I saw this program about cooking the other day, and a guy was like, okay, if it's burned, don't put it on the plate. I guess the same is true in games. If the gameplay idea isn't fleshed out, don't put it in the game.
Yeah, I think maybe some games, some of the most feature-packed epic RPGs can sometimes get away with the fact of having quite poorly developed ideas, because they know there's a sheer amount of them will help make the game better. But yeah, you certainly get this thing within Crysis and Perfect Dark, especially within the weird ghosts that fly towards you at the end of the original Fear, where, and of course, the little bugs that scuttle along the floor and explode in Singularity, which I know something you know all about.
Yep.
Is when I don't have time to develop this idea, but I'm just going to throw it in anyway, because any variety is good variety, and you actually end up undermining the quality of your product. So I guess the idea, maybe a lesson here for developers, if you could ever say there are any lessons out of our podcasts, is knowing when to say no to additional mechanics, knowing when to concentrate on your core feature set.
Okay, so that is unfortunately all we have time for.
Awesome.
Do you want to do a conclusion?
I don't really think that we need a conclusion. I think our podcast speaks for itself.
Or are you just conclusion-averse?
I am very conclusion-averse. Everything is a discussion, nothing is a conclusion.
Okay, thanks for listening. If you want to get in touch, you can email us at gamingbydesign@gmail.com, or you can get in touch via the blog, gamingbydesign.blogspot.com. Next topic is, should we announce the next topic?
Yeah, why not?
So the next episode is going to be the last episode, and we're going to be talking about the golden rules of gaming.
So yeah, the final episode, very emotionally, the final episode, will be about the golden rules of gaming. So I guess it's kind of, will be kind of a ranty, kind of get things off our chest, the things that appear in games that are always, always shit, and we wish that they were never in games, why are they in games? So basically, we're going to go out on a low with a massive teenagery rant.
And we'll also have a special guest.
We might do, yes.
Okay. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.